Welcome to the final Studio 2 episode of May. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I was about to say, oh my goodness, can you believe it? But yes, I can.
I say stick with it.
I know. Yes, that's your I thing. Can. The next time we'll be on air will be in June. So we have a lot to talk about today. Folks are going to be converging here in Philadelphia for a big time regatta in dragon boating.
Say that again.
Dragon boating. Dragon boat racing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have it right here in Philadelphia. They're going to be all along the Schuylkill River. Hundreds of teams. Mm-hmm. Well over 100 teams. So I'm looking forward to that. We're going to find out what dragon boat racing is,
mm-hmm.
The biceps and the abs that come with it and all that, and why people love it so much. So I'm looking forward to that conversation later this segment. Our big segment for today is about Living Oregon donation. Should people be compensated if they decide to give a kidney to a stranger? And we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting pro-con debate. It's been raging for a while, but there is a new-ish proposal around how to potentially compensate people for giving their kidney or giving an organ to a stranger. And we'll talk about that. We're also going to talk with someone who donated her kidney to a stranger about a decade ago to get that first person account. So that's all coming up on the show today. If you have comments on either topic, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Get those emails in now. We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely. And now we're going to dig into the news. And the big story, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris came to Philadelphia, and they were at Girard College yesterday in an attempt to earn black voters' support for the upcoming election. We've been talking about this. You've probably heard it on national news. The Biden administration has been losing support among black voters. A lot of folks are just not paying attention, have lost enthusiasm. And so they launched their voter engagement effort, their national voter engagement effort, right here in Philadelphia. This is part of what the Biden campaign describes as a summer-long effort to engage black student organizations, community groups, and faith centers. And just to give you some statistics, among black adults, Biden's approval has dropped from 94% when he started his term to just 55%. So he has a lot of work to do.
According to one poll, you never know how real that is. Mm-hmm. But let's hear a clip about the sort of the pitch that Biden made yesterday to voters at Girard College. Can we roll that?
Because black Americans voted, Kamala and I are president and vice president of the United States because of you. That's not hyperbole. Because you voted, Donald Trump has defeated former president. And with your vote in 2024, we're going to make Donald Trump a loser again.
So that's part of the message. I need you. I need you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he also touched on several issues. But look, he's not wrong about any of that. I do think he needs black voters. And it's an interesting place to launch that campaign here in Philadelphia. Obviously, big city. Obviously, in a swing state. But also maybe a little less obviously, even though Biden carried Pennsylvania, Donald Trump did pretty well in Philadelphia in 2020. His share of the vote far outpaced what Republican candidates have typically done in past cycles. So this is a city that he has focused on and clearly needs to focus on.
It absolutely does. And by the way, black voters make up roughly 10% of the vote in Pennsylvania. And even a slight dip in support among black voters could cost Biden the election. And so every single vote counts.
Let's stay in Pennsylvania now for our second story. You probably have heard that there was this big opioid settlement, and this happened all over the country. Here in Pennsylvania, counties are going to get about $1 billion as part of this settlement with opioid producers. The question is, how will counties spend that money? And a few counties, a trio of counties, want to use some of the money for coroner's offices, and that has generated some backlash. This story comes to us from Spotlight PA. It's a relatively small sum of money overall, about $200,000, that a trio of counties, Chester, Lawrence, and Lehigh, want to earmark for coroner's offices. But it's inspired this debate about exactly what types of offices and efforts should you be able to use this money on, because it's supposed to be earmarked to help solve the opioid crisis here in Pennsylvania. And critics say, look, we should be looking for ways to keep people alive, not looking for ways to handle opioid deaths. And there is a particular fear that by giving money to coroner's offices, that will be used as a prosecutorial technique to charge the people who dealt the drugs that led to the death after the coroner has established that drugs are the cause of an overdose death. So there is some potential tie into the criminal justice system here. On the other side, coroner's offices are also really, really vital wellsprings of data and statistics because they can determine how someone dies, and that can help you track whether a trend is going up or a trend is going down with respect to drug use and overdose deaths. So there's, I think, vital arguments here on both sides, but I had never really considered whether or not opioid settlement money should be used for something like a coroner's office.
Yeah, and we have to remember the coroner's offices were strained because of the increase of opioid and overdose deaths. Also, some of these counties have said, and the counties are Chester County, Lawrence, and Lehigh counties, they've said that, look, we could use this money to run tests to educate treatment facilities, to find out if some of these folks were in treatment and maybe something happened, we could use that data for good to save lives. So definitely something up for debate. We don't know what the ultimate outcome will be, but there's a lot of talk about it. Something else that has been a topic of conversation, and we're going down to Delaware for this one. Homelessness in Delaware is up 9%. That's according to the state's most recent report. And it's the point in time report. That's where, you know, officials from the state go around and literally count the number of people who do not have housing. And it's a 10-day count of the number of residents who are unsheltered. And you could be sleeping in a car or an encampment. And the 2024 count is a 9% increase from last year. It's the highest on record in Delaware, excluding 2 years during the pandemic. And since 2020, homelessness has increased by almost 60%. That's according to this count. They are accounting for the milder weather. There is a number of reasons, and the majority of folks who are houseless in Delaware are people of color, African Americans.
If you want to read more about this story, head on over to WHYY.org. Johnny Perez Gonzalez has a story up about it right now, looking at the trends in Delaware, and they do reflect some national trends as well. So it's something worth your time. Finally, before we end our news chat today, we want to head overseas.
Yeah.
To Sweden. I'll explain. Cherry, do you shred? Do you ollie?
I don't
do
even
kick flip?
Know
do you
what
hit the
that
one?
Is.
You know, okay, so no. These are skateboarding terms, I think. And you might remember that Philadelphia's Love Park really used to be a mecca for skateboarders. And that was because of the built landscape there. You could do all sorts of skateboardy stuff. I think it was technically you weren't supposed to skateboard there, but it kind of just became a spot for skateboarders. Then Love Park got redesigned recently, and it's not so great for skateboarding anymore. But it's still kind of an iconic place in the minds of the skateboarding community. So in Malmo, Sweden, Malmo is a city of about 300,000 in Sweden, if you didn't know, they are creating a mini recreated version of Philadelphia's Love Park with some of even the same actual stones that used to be in the old Love Park. And it's specifically for skateboarders, the version in Malmo. And it's a tribute to skateboarding culture, to this great place in skateboarding lore, and a great place in Philadelphia lore. So you can go now to Love Park Recreated 2.0 in Malmo, Sweden.
And I see that some people from Philadelphia have actually done that. So Philly everywhere.
What do you mean?
Have gone. They said skateboarders from Philadelphia have traveled there.
Already?
To be the first to skate on this new reconstructed Love Park. So, yeah.
Fun fact, one of the designers of Love Park, the original Love Park, was Ed Bacon, who was a major city planner in Philadelphia for many, many years. And Ed Bacon is Kevin Bacon's father.
I was about to say, the father of
another famous Bacon. So we don't even need six degrees of Kevin Bacon on this one. Like, you get two and a half degrees and you're right there.
I love it.
Let's stay in the sports world now.
Yeah. Over 100 paddling teams will take to the Schuylkill on Saturday for the Independence Dragon Boat Regatta. Picture longboats that fit 20 people gliding down the river in this ancient Chinese water sport that has exploded in popularity around the world and in our region.
From the most competitive racers to community teams, dragon boating attracts people of all ages and genders. And in case you've never heard of dragon boating, you don't ride a dragon, so you know.
Clarify.
Our next guest is going to fill us in on the sport, the upcoming regatta, and what makes it all so special. Tommy Leonardi is Philadelphia Dragon Boat Association team president. He's also the president of the Schuylkill Paddlers Incorporated. Tommy Leonardi, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tommy, for folks who don't know what dragon boat racing is, please explain, because it is not rowing, right?
It is not rowing, yes. The difference between rowing and paddling is when you row a boat, it goes backward. When you paddle a boat, whether it's a dragon boat, a kayak, a canoe, it goes forward. So that's your main difference. A dragon boat specifically is a 40-foot-long canoe that has 10 rows of seats, and you have two people in each row, and you're either on the left side or the right side when you're paddling. You're not switching while you're paddling. You also have two other people on the boat. You have someone in the back who's steering, and then the fun part is you have someone on the front who's the drummer, and there's actually a drum. And the drummer usually is giving commands and giving the crew a sense of where they are in the course and what they need to do strategically as the race goes on.
Does the drum keep the rhythm of like the paddlers? Is that also part of it?
It's in coordination.
Okay.
Okay. Depending on the level of the team, you might have the drummer set the rhythm, whereas a more competitive team would typically have the drummer follow the rhythm of the stroke pair.
Yeah. And so, Phil, yeah.
Phil, there's 22 people on this boat overall.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. It's a lot of coordination. It's, you know, I also coach myself. I coach a club in Bucks County, and it's really choreography. Mm-hmm. Trying to get 20 people to do something in unison while under, you know, physical duress and still look like it's easy. It's very similar to a dance troupe in that vein.
I love it. And I got to ask you, because it's big, this sport is really big in Philadelphia, and we have a long history of dragon boating. Tell us a little bit about it, because it's a Chinese sport, and we've sort of adopted it.
Well, to be clear, it's been adopted all over the world.
Yeah.
But a group from Hong Kong 41 years ago came to Boathouse Row, where U.S. rowing happened to be centered at the time, and came to us and said, hey, we've got this sport called dragon boating. We will provide a boat and paddles and some instruction. And if you get a team together, you can come to Hong Kong and you can race. And they got enough people to say, yeah, let's do it. And that's where it started. And the following year, Bob McNamara, who was our longtime coach, joined the club, and he got the bug also. And he's a rower. I mean, he was a coach at LaSalle. He was a rower as well, very competitive. And he since has, you know, taken the reins and has been he's one of the first two coaches inducted into the International Dragon Boat Federation's Hall of Fame just this past year in Thailand.
Let's row back in time now.
Yeah.
Backwards, right? This is a 1983 news segment about the very first U.S. dragon boat team and their bid to win the world championships in Hong Kong. Roll that clip.
The choppy waters of Hong Kong Harbor proved far different from the peaceful Schuylkill. The day before the event, the extra-heavy American boat was swamped. But on race day, optimism still ran high among the Americans.
This is for Philadelphia!
Wow. So how has our level changed since then? What's the level of skill for Philadelphia paddlers compared to, you know, 83?
Well, the Philadelphia Dragon Boat Association is the winningest club in the U.S. I mean, it's not just because of our longevity. It's also because of our coach and also our overall leadership throughout the years. Just bringing new people in, always being welcoming. You know, when it comes to our club specifically, anyone can come and try us out, practice with us for free for a month.
Free for a month. And then about how much does it cost to stick with it?
Well, every club's different. Our club is $225 for a year. But that's partially because, it's mainly because, not partially, we have this regatta, which helps offset a lot of the costs of the running the sport.
And as we get ready to wrap up, I want you to talk about the regatta. It's this weekend. It's a big deal. You guys are not rowing. I mean, paddling. Let me clarify.
You guys
are not paddling. Tell us about what people can expect.
Well, you're going to have 102 teams. It's the largest single day dragon boat event in the United States, and I think North America as well. Canada has a lot of events. It's going to start at 8 a.m. We're going to have Bob Mina, who is an amazing. He could have his own radio show. Let's just put it that way. An amazing MC, and we completely staff it on our own. You got to think, right? We have all these people who have paddled around the world from our club, who have been at hundreds, if not thousands, of combined regattas. So over time, we've learned how to run them ourselves. And what makes our regatta special, I believe, is that we have so many members who care so much and have been doing this so much and know what to do and know how to help other clubs, that the clubs keep coming back.
And you keep coming back. Real quick, what do you love about the sensation of being in a dragon boat?
It's interesting. It's really meditation because you're doing something, you know, rhythmically under some type of physical duress, but you have to concentrate. At the same time, you have to relax, because if you're too tense, your technique will fall apart. So it's a bit of each.
Body and mind.
Body and mind.
Well, that is Tommy Leonardi, Philadelphia Dragon Boat Association president and president of the Schuylkill Paddlers Incorporated. Tommy, thanks for schooling us on dragon boating.
Thank you for having me.
Loved hearing from you. Coming up, the debate over paying living organ donors. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. There is a shortage of organs for transplant in the United States. More than 100,000 people are on the national organ waiting list, and thousands die each year before they get a transplant.
So, how do you increase the number of donors? One idea is to get more living donors by offering financial incentives. And there's a movement to do just that, all revolving around this thing called the End Kidney Deaths Act. So, would you give a kidney to a stranger for some kind of monetary compensation? And what ethical questions would that raise? We have three guests joining us now to talk about this entire dilemma. I will introduce first our guests in the studio. Dr. Gregory Hess is a physician, a transplant recipient, and an advocate for compensating living donors. Dr. Hess, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Lauren Shepard, also in studio with us, is a living donor. She donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. Lauren, thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line, we have Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan is the Doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor of Medical Ethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. Art Kaplan, so nice to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to know what you think. Should we pay people who donate an organ? Would you consider giving a kidney to a stranger if you were financially compensated? What problems could that raise? Call us or email your thoughts. The number 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org.
Greg Hess, I wanted to start with you. Give us a sense of the scope of the problem here and the consequences of this gap between the number of donated organs and the people who need one.
Sure. It's a growing problem, and that's one of the reasons that the solutions are being proposed that you spoke about. But briefly, you know, we have anywhere between 90,000 to 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list waiting for an organ. And while that's happening, of course, particularly for kidney patients, they're failing every day. They're getting worse and worse. And then they get to the point that they're actually so sick that they have to be taken off the waiting list, and unfortunately, they pass away.
And so, about how many donations are there in a given year? So there's 90 to 100,000 waiting, and about how many organs available?
Yeah, it varies by which organization counts them and exactly when, et cetera, but it's roughly 25,000 kidney donors per year, or excuse me, kidney transplants occur per year.
And so walk us through the process for folks who may not understand how you go about giving a kidney and receiving a kidney. Walk us through that process.
Sure. Generally, it starts with a phone call, and you call a transplant center, and they would ask you to register, fill out a form online, and then from there, you'll get a call from the transplant center. They'll then confirm the information that you've put in there. Then eventually, it'll lead to where you actually go in person to the transplant center, and they'll put you through a very thorough physical, as well as CAT scans, things along those lines to look at your health, and then also mental health, if you would, discussion or exam, and then very much so on that last point to make sure that you're not being coerced and that you're doing it of your own free will, hopefully very thorough informed consent so you understand the risk and the benefits, and then people would move through the process. It takes quite a bit of time, but I would say in general, the average is probably about 6 months between when you start and when you might be able to donate.
And so you believe, your argument is that people should be compensated to go through this process.
They should, for a variety of reasons. But to me, the most important piece along that line is that this is a proposed study. So it's a pilot study. And the way we advance things in medicine and science is to look at the data, look at the facts. So right now we know the facts are this would just be for altruistic, meaning non-directed donors donating to a stranger. Last year we had 400 people donate. So we're not starting out with a dramatic number here, but we are hoping that with this compensation, based on studies and things done before, that this would definitely accelerate it. And we're hoping for 6,000 people a year donating rather than 400. And that if that's tracked over a 10-year period, we'll learn the facts and data from this. Does it work? Does compensation actually both protect the donors and benefit the recipients?
And just to clarify, you're talking about this proposed End Kidney Deaths Act. 10-year pilot program would provide a $50,000 refundable tax credit over 5 years to living kidney donors. And I think there are some details within that, but that's the broad scope of this one proposal. Of course, it has generated some backlash, and I want to bring in a caller now. This is Will, who wants to weigh in. Will, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Actually, it's Bill, and I live in West Mount Airy. I'm a 71-year-old guy, and I've given blood over 80 times, and I'm shooting for 100 times. So, and so I'm very big on organ donation. I also wrote my PhD dissertation on an issue in medical ethics. So I think that it's wrong to compensate people for this for several reasons. One is when you give altruistically without getting compensated, you're more likely to not need the money. You know, I think if people are compensated, especially a huge amount of money like $50,000, there'd be a lot of pressure on poor people from within themselves as well as their friends and neighbors to give their organs. And also with the experience of paying people for blood, the blood is generally not as good quality as it is when somebody gives altruistically for free. And so I really think this is an important issue. And I tried to give my kidney about a year ago, but I didn't qualify primarily because of my age and the condition of my kidney because I was older. So I really encourage people to donate, but not for money. I don't think money is a good idea.
Interesting. So that's Bill's perspective from Mount Airy. And I'm sorry I got your name wrong, Bill. I want to kick this now to Art Kaplan, bioethicist at NYU. So you just heard one potential downside of a compensation program. Anything else to add in that vein, Art?
Well, there are important things to think about. We've had proposals for compensation for about 40 years, and they never go far because, first, there's major opposition from religious groups, Catholics, evangelicals, Orthodox Jews. They don't believe that you own your body, and it's not something they think you can commodify or sell. And you may say, well, I don't care what they think. It's up to me. But you don't want those people dropping out of a system because you create money for organs. Secondly, you're going to have to run a dual system. What we're talking about here is just for kidneys, but you can't do it for hearts or livers. You can't do it for lungs. And so it's too dangerous, by the way, for lungs to take one. So you try to run them against one another at the same time. And I think that would be hugely upsetting to the rest of the organ transplant world. I don't see the heart people and the liver people coming forward and saying, yeah, let's do a kidney market. That's the way to go. And by the way, we're not talking about donors anymore. We're talking about sellers. As soon as we make the switch, it's nice to retain the altruistic language, but we have to describe it for what it is. I think the other reason to be cautious here is that there are things we need to try before we get into trying to regulate a market and risk, as the caller said, exploitation and even pressure on people. You know, pay your gambling debts. You've got a kidney. Let's get out there and sell it. We have the opportunity to do what other parts of the world are doing, which is to switch from opt-in, I want to be an organ donor, I'm calling up, to the presumption that when you die, you will be an organ donor unless you opt out and basically say, I don't want to do it. In parts of the world that do that, Austria, Belgium, now Wales, Scotland, you do see significant increases. We don't have to speculate. It helps. And so we can make
the
shift.
Could that also incur some backlash from the same religious groups you mentioned earlier?
No, because you can still opt out. It's just saying you have a choice. We can frame it so that you have to jump into it, or we can frame it so that it's up to you to opt out of it or say, I don't want to do it. But you still retain the right, if you don't want to do it, not to do it. It just makes the default, it's a little bit like you don't have to eat your vegetables, but if I put them in the lunch line first, maybe you're more likely to do it than if I put them at the end of the lunch line after all the desserts and other high-calorie things. So we could set up a assumption, but still give the freedom to say no. And let me mention one other reason there's a problem here. I know I'm on long here, but the transplant system right now is inefficient and has all kinds of problems in terms of cadaver donation as things now stand. Congress has basically said, fix it, and they're trying to shake it up. I'm not going to go into all the details, but there are ways to increase efficiency by better public campaigns, trying to put in right now a market and selling into the system as it is. Efforts are underway to make it more efficient, I think would probably overwhelm the system. So just in practical terms, bad timing.
And our quick follow-up, I mean, what makes organs so different from other bodily, you know, issues that we sell, like sperm, blood, eggs from a woman? That's a real, when you talk about egg donation, that's a real process that women have to go through. Lots of vetting in order to make that happen. All those things are compensated for. Why would organs, and specifically kidneys, be different from those?
Well, two reasons. One, the sperm egg situation, they're renewable. So when you give that kidney, you're down to one. If you then get diabetes or an injury or something happens, you become in trouble in a very different way than a sperm or an egg seller might be. The other problem, if you will, is you've got a situation where you may get people trying to sell where you're going to promote the rich, the people who get the compensation start to move up to the head of the line, the poor start to fall behind. You get equity issues about trying to run this market with, you know, I want to sell my organ, but I only want to sell it to Cherry. I don't want to sell it to anybody else.
So I want to bring in a comment that's very much agreeing with what you're saying, Art. This is Aria, who says financial need can be used as a form of coercion and no one should be coerced in any manner to give up an organ. The problem is you can live without one kidney, but God forbid you have a health issue and you're going to run out of options quick. So Aria is echoing what Art Kaplan just said. Greg, I just want to give you a chance to respond real quick, because I think there's this question in particular of, could we have a tightly regulated market around this that could be fair, that could be equitable, that could, you know, facilitate this exchange without becoming exploitative? Can you address that and perhaps a couple of the other points that Art brought up?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, we do not view this at all as exploitive. The fact is that right now, people who are in lower educational levels and lower income levels are disproportionately less likely to get a kidney transplant. If we provide compensation, and again, remember, this is just a pilot study for 10 years, starting out with only altruistic donors. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. So if someone's in trouble with a, quote, gambling debt, those types of scenarios are, to me, really fantastical. They simply don't occur because, again, you have at least three groups of protections going on in this pilot to collect evidence. And again, those, you know, protections would be that, first of all, I've in fact worked with uninsured patients, very low income, as a volunteer for the last 20 years. And the experience is that those individuals can make very sound decisions, what's best for them, as long as they're provided with informed consent. And there is extremely thorough informed consent in this process.
Give them the choice. Yeah. Don't assume that they can't make the choice is what you're saying.
Exactly. And this is not a market. This is, again, that it's going to be tightly regulated just as it is now. It is a tax credit that would come back mm-hmm. from the federal government over a five-year period. And this amount of money, for example, was tested with Americans, in fact, American voters, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2016. And 60% of people they interviewed who were voters said that they would favor compensation. So a number of the things that Dr. Kaplan, you know, respectfully brings up, I think, are illusions. Perhaps the last point I make is there are many, many other ethicists who disagree with this point of view. I have a quote here from Professor Jaworski at Georgetown, for example, we could read. But he simply says that for 40 years, we've had this problem. And he says at the end, we owe it to our family, friends, and neighbors to act. Compensation of donors through a highly regulated system is the best way forward.
And we want to talk to someone who actually stepped up and was an altruistic donor. Lauren, tell us a little bit about, you've been listening to this conversation. You were not compensated
Correct.
For your kidney donation.
Correct.
Walk us through what you went through to make this gift.
Yeah. So when I learned about living donation, I just thought, hey, I could do that. So I did it. I don't need the other kidney, right? But I think a big thing that's happening here is oversimplification, right? We think like, oh, it's just like you're going to go in and donate blood. You're going to fill out this questionnaire and they're going to take your blood and you're good. They're going to give you $50,000 and out you go. In my experience, it was a lot of testing, a lot of dedication on my part. I went to an information session first, then a psych eval, tons of blood drawn. I mean, a lot very mm-hmm. often. It took 7 months before my donation. I had an EKG. I wore a heart monitor. I had to collect urine samples in a tub for 24 hours. It's not a pretty process. It's not an easy process.
You're saying it's not get rich quick.
Correct. It's not get rich quick. And the thing is that the medical professionals, if you are not qualified, you won't do it. They take your family history. If you have family history of any kind of kidney disease, you're not going to donate. So they're looking at like, what's your likelihood?
And Lauren, I got to ask you, I mean, what compensation have helped you going through this
Absolutely.
Process? You were 28 years old.
Yes.
Young.
Yes.
You know, probably not making a ton of money
Correct.
At the time.
Yes.
Would compensation have helped
Absolutely.
You?
And I was very lucky in that my lease ended in December. I donated in January, so I didn't renew it. I stayed with my parents. They took great care of me. But not everybody has that. I had to go back to work afterwards. You know, that's just what I had to do. And so it absolutely being incentivized would have helped. I would have done it either way. I think saying that the rich people are going to get the money, if you don't need it, you can donate that money. Nobody has to tell you what to do with that money. You don't have to squirrel it away. You mm-hmm. can, you know, you can give that to people. You can put it back in the donation or the donor fund or whatever. It's, I think it's kind of silly to say that the rich people are going to get that. And I also think it's kind of interesting to say that people who have money are the ones donating because, yeah, of course we are because we're not being compensated,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I could have afforded to do that. But if I did it now, maybe I couldn't because I have a child and a house and all that. Maybe I wouldn't be able to at this point in my life. So it's something to think about, that more people would have the opportunity to participate in this if they were compensated.
I want to bring in a question from Nancy in media, inspired by something we said earlier. And I think we'll have to answer this after the break so we can all think about it. Nancy says, I have considered kidney donation, but been dissuaded by the concern that I might someday need my spare, as many people are. Why isn't there a system that puts donors at the head of the list if they later need a kidney? That might reassure potential donors and could make donations more common. And I think we do have an answer to that question, but we have to get to that after the break. We are talking about living organ donation on Studio 2. Stick with us. This is 90.9.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are continuing our conversation about organ donation shortages and how to get more donors. Some people have suggested offering financial compensation, and we're talking about the thorny ethical issues that it could raise and other problems in the organ donation system.
We have three guests this hour. Let me reintroduce them. Dr. Gregory Hess is a physician and a transplant recipient and an advocate for compensating living donors. Lauren Shepherd is a living donor. She donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. And Art Kaplan is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor of Medical Ethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. And we had that question before the break from Nancy about, you know,
if you donate
a kidney and then later, you know, you have problems with your remaining kidney, should you go to the top of the list? So let me direct that question to you, Lauren, because you're in that position. What happens after you give a kidney in terms of your priority for future treatment?
Yeah. So first, I do want to reiterate that you most likely will not be on the list if you are at high risk for future kidney disease. So you won't be able to donate if the doctors see that you are a potential risk in the future. But as far as being moved to the top list, you are. So I donated through the National Kidney Registry, which coordinates a lot of the altruistic donations in the country. It's a voucher system now. When I did it, it was just kind of like you get moved to the top of the list, I believe, but it was a little less organized. But now there's a voucher system, and I believe it even extends to your family members. So if my son, for instance, needed a kidney one day, he's going to get moved up because I donated a kidney to a stranger in the past.
Wow, very interesting. I want to bring in a caller. Joanne is on the line, wants to talk about the ethical issues. Joanne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My ethics is sort of convoluted about this. I would donate a kidney, but I would be offended if somebody offered to pay me for it.
Very interesting. And I want to also read another comment. Paul writes, yes, people should get paid. Poverty is raging. But no, I would not do it for money. I'd only do it to save key personal loved ones, if at all. But I'd help others in need find other donors. So there's this feeling there that it should be altruistic among some people. I want to bring Art back into the conversation. Art, you've heard this conversation about a lot of people have hesitation about this the compensation. I want to talk about some of the other issues with the donation system. And one of the ones is you talked about the clogs that are in the matching. How could we fix that and open it up so that more people could get donations or be recipients of donors every single year?
Yeah, well, first, let me toss out one idea, Cherry, if I may. Dr. Hess, Ms. Shepherd, maybe we could agree on something. I'm not in favor of incentivizing with money people to sell their kidneys, but I am absolutely in favor of making sure that they don't incur costs. They're expenses. Mm. You have to go to a hotel. You have to find maybe some compensation for away from work, as Ms. Shepherd was talking about. There are other expenses, even making sure that you have health insurance. You don't want people selling kidneys who aren't insured, and there are plenty of underinsured and not insured people out there. So one thing to do is to fill the gap with money to help people who have legitimate expenses but still want to be an altruistic donor. That might be a position we might all agree on moving forward. That said, the system has trouble, the whole organ, the world of organ donation. It is running with inefficient software, outdated computers. They can't do quick matches. We lose too many potential organs that are donated because they don't get assigned to somebody whose blood type and antibody type might match. We have troubles making sure that an organ that appears maybe not to be 100% top quality still could be used in somebody who's much older and doesn't need a warranty of 40 years of life from their kidney. So the system needs reform. We also have inefficiencies. There's a system set up regional of organ procurement organizations, and the country is divided into areas, and they go out. When someone dies, they try to approach the family and ask if they would consider organ donation. That's fine, but there are some that just have terrible rates compared to others of people saying yes. They're not doing it well. They're either bullying the family or they're being inaccurate. We've got to fix the requests that go not so much for living donors, but for cadaver donors. And I'm going to repeat again, the system right now is in upheaval. There's worry that, you know, in trying to fix the many problems that it has, it's fragile. And so going into the regulated sale market right now, tough thing to do. Might be better to take that step toward compensating reasonable expenses, see if that helps, motivates more people to think about it.
A middle road in a sense, and Greg Hess, let me bring you back in because you're a transplant recipient yourself. Yep. Mm-hmm. When you're getting on the list, we have this thing in quotes, the list, but it's really not that simple, right? Like you can call different centers. It sounds more chaotic in practice than, hey, I'm going to put myself on the list. I mean, when you went through this process, how did it work?
You know, at the end of the day, you know, my perspective is that the hospital systems in general are not well engineered for smooth sailing. At an individual level, the physicians and nurses and other people are compassionate, they're smart, they're incredibly hardworking. But in terms of adopting quickly best practices and uniformity, we certainly have a lot of room for improvement in that system. No question about it. And fully recognize what Dr. Kaplan's saying, and I would agree, you know, that there is inefficiencies that should be improved. And those, though, that he referred to are largely either occurring already and have not moved the needle. For example, donor expenses for out-of-pocket expenses are covered largely either by the National Living Donor Assistance Center or they're covered by private groups such as the National Kidney Registry. And that hasn't moved the needle at all when we look at the trends of numbers of people who are dying on the wait list, who are not getting transplanted. So that's why we really feel strongly that then you have to look at other solutions. And again, you need to test them and to do studies. And this, for example, End Kidney Death Act is, again, a proposal to study this and look at the facts and data. If it doesn't move the needle, great, go on to the next solution. If it does, great, we've found something that's going to help living donors.
And let's talk about other solutions, because there are efforts to work on non-human organs that could help fill the gap. How close are we to that becoming a real option?
It's an interesting question. I actually review grants that are research grants looking at ways to do exactly what you're chatting about. So certainly I'm sure we've all heard that there was a pig kidney specifically and specially genetically modified. There have been two transplanted recently, and to my last recollection, both of those recipients are doing well, which is great. So hopefully that will accelerate, but right, two people are not going to solve the problem, unfortunately, today. So we have a fairly long way to go before that would be really reviewed by the FDA in regular practice, et cetera, and really making a significant dent. But I hope it does work. That would be great. And then there are other devices that people have talked about and thought about. So hopefully those solutions will come in. I'm all in favor of incremental solutions if we can all piece them together. But right now, today, accelerating living donors is by far the best because it lasts twice as long as a deceased kidney. And that was largely the system reform that Dr. Kaplan's talking about. It's going to really work on the deceased kidney system.
Lauren, you decided to take this step and donate a kidney. In the meantime, assuming that there is no reform coming tomorrow, do you have conversations with people about this? Mm-hmm. Do people ask you about this? And what do you tell them? I'm not saying perhaps even necessarily that you try to convince them to do it, but what are those conversations like? And what do you tell people about the experience?
I would do it again in a heartbeat. Mm. I donated to a stranger, which is a very unique experience in that, like, I didn't get to choose who it went to or anything. I did meet him eventually, came to my wedding. We have a good relationship. So I'm very lucky in that aspect. But had I never met him, I still would do it again just because to me it felt like the right thing to do. And I know that's not going to feel the same way for everybody, and that's completely understandable. But just for me, it felt like I was doing the right thing, and I still feel like I did the right thing. And at the end of the day, that's what gets me through, you know, helps me sleep at night. But that being said, if the government was giving me a tax credit for it, I still would have done it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to read this comment from Alexis, who said, 2 years ago, I began the process of becoming a living non-directed kidney donor. I was denied the opportunity by the donation board because she had a medical condition. And the board decided that she was too much of a risk of not being able to deal with that process. She felt like a personal failure being turned down and wants to reapply. And so I want to sort of, we only have a couple more minutes, but I want to talk about the future of organ donation. I mean, this is something that saves a lot of lives. What does it look like? I mean, what should we be thinking about as we look into trying to make change and the likelihood of whether or not, you know, compensation will even become feasible.
Gary, can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Add a little bit just for a little science fiction at the end. So I'm at the place where one of the pig kidneys was done at NYU. And I think so far, you know, so good. One of the gentlemen got it at the Mass General, but he died. But our recipient is still okay. I think we are 5 years away from having this either established or giving up, but it is a path. Freezing organs is an interesting idea because if you could bank them and start to store them, that's a technology that people are working on very aggressively. The longer term way to perhaps solve some of our problems is to try and reduce the need for the kidneys. So we got a lot of diabetes and a lot of obesity in the U.S. Maybe our injectable drugs will help us reduce those rates because kidney failure, you know, there are genetic forms, but there are definitely lifestyle related problems. And we got to work on that. We don't want to just transplant as a solution. We want to get into prevention as a solution. So weirdly enough, the world of the injectable drugs, lowering weight, helping diabetics, helping against heart disease, this may help reduce the demand because it's been escalating and escalating, I'm going to say primarily due to lifestyle issues.
Well, they say, and I think maybe even Ben Franklin was the first to say this, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So we'll end on that Philly note, that Philly connection. I want to thank everybody. This is a fascinating conversation. It's an important conversation, and it's an evolving conversation. So we're going to keep it going. Again, our guests were Art Kaplan, professor of medical ethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine, Dr. Gregory Hess, physician and a transplant recipient himself, and Lauren Shepherd, who donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, and that brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. Our show was produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you next week.